All right, the time is now 10:04. We will start the January meeting of the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. My name is Cindy Collier. I'm here with Norma Hutchins and Shamari Wade. We are the three sitting members currently. Do we have any changes to the agenda? Hearing no changes, I will entertain a motion to adopt the agenda.
I move to adopt the agenda.
All in favor?
Aye.
That has been adopted. We'll start with our report from Ms. Hughes.
Thank you. It's brief since we were just here 2 weeks ago. The Office of Open Government has not conducted any training since the last meeting of the board on December 21st of last year. We have responded to one Open Meetings Act request for advice and three FOIA requests for advice, one of which includes assisting a member of the public in drafting a request. No formal opinions have been issued. The office now has an online application developed by Wada Katab on our staff that allows the Office of Open Government to more precisely track and categorize by requester and issues pertaining to all advice given by the Office of Open Government concerning compliance with the Open Meetings Act and the Freedom of Information Act. The database holds any correspondence and files that relate to the formal and informal advice issued on both areas of law. Finally, we have been in contact for some time now with the Capital Area Food Bank per Mr. Barton's outreach. The Capital Area Food Bank has requested information about the Office of Open Government to be included in their January newsletter. Specifically, their interest is assisting the public in filing FOIA requests, but they just requested a general blurb about the office. But this is part of our outreach. That concludes my update.
I believe at some point that you actually have done some public training outside of government employees. And I know you were pursuing online training. Regarding the public outreach training, have you developed anything further on that?
I have a specific training that's called the ABCs of Open Records that's online, and that's the training that the office uses to generally inform the public about the requirements of the Open Meetings Act and the Freedom of Information Act.
In terms of going to different community organizations?
We've met with one organization so far and have had contact with one ANC, but we haven't set up any specific meetings with the ANCs as of yet. As it pertains to the remote training, the online training, we had been working with MOTA specifically on the Open Meetings Act portion. I don't know where that is. We have not developed a remote training where we don't give in person for community outreach purposes. And I also don't think that that's necessarily appropriate. I think that it's very helpful for a representative from the Office of Open Government to be there in person to answer questions and also just generally inform the public when there are specific questions or issues that residents may have concerning both areas of law. You're welcome.
Thank you. Regarding the Office of Government Ethics, update on our operations since the last meeting, we have not opened any new investigations. We have closed one investigation since our last meeting. Currently, we have 8 investigations open, and 9 investigations have been stayed and are currently inactive. One of those is because it's a fugitive in a court case. One is pending motions before the Office of Employee Appeals. 5 are being worked by the Office of the Inspector General, and 2 have been referred to the Office of the Attorney General pending Civil False Claims Act complaints. Regarding our publication and reporting obligations, we have no outstanding publication or reporting obligations. The best practices report was delivered to the mayor and all council members on Friday, December 29th. Our quarterly complaint report will be posted to the website early next week, and our agency performance measures will be completed before the next board's meeting.
Thanks. Before you go on, I just want to say thank you to Mr. Grimaldi for organizing, drafting the best practices report. It was very detailed and thorough and 50 pages long.
And my last
We'll talk about it.
Regarding trainings and outreach, there were no training programs attended by staff since the last board's meeting. And conducted by the staff during the past 2 weeks, we conducted only two training sessions consisting of a new employee orientation and a MSS presentation, which is considerably less than the 14 conducted last month. But a lot of that is probably attributable to the fact that it was the holiday season and kind of a slow time for government in general.
Sure. I'll pose the same question that I posed to Ms. Hughes about the public outreach training. I know at one point, Mr. Flowers, you were working on training specific to the public. Have you gotten anywhere on that?
It's my understanding that the road show, so to speak, is still a work in progress, and it's something that we definitely intend to complete and begin providing that type of outreach. I know through my experience at the OIG, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, we had outreaches to nursing homes and just a variety of neighborhood associations. And I envision having the same approach for the Office of Government Ethics, because I do believe that the more folks are aware of our operations, the more they will be able to avail themselves of the services that we render, and hopefully provide that assurance that there is an entity in district government that is looking out to make sure that all of the district government's officials are complying with the code of conduct. Next item on our report is advisory opinions and advice. We've provided approximately 20 instances of informal advice giving since the board's last meeting, down from 71. This measures our performance over a two-week period rather than a six-week period. And formal advice requests, we currently have one pending request for a formal advisory opinion that was received earlier this week. The subject matter of that opinion is permissible activities involving hosting quote-unquote meet and greet events, not fundraisers, for partisan political candidates under the District of Columbia Hatch Act, ethics laws, or election expenditures laws. The request for a formal opinion was very detailed, and we anticipate being able to provide that guidance relatively quickly. Regarding ethics legislation and the Comprehensive Code of Conduct, we are not aware of any recent developments with respect to either of those items. Since this is the budget season, the Budget Support Act is a vehicle that is often used to tweak agency operations. We do not have any concrete proposals for the BSA at this time, although we are researching whether we need to have BEGA statutorily established as a law enforcement agency to enhance and expand our investigative resources and toolkit. In one of our investigations, make sure it's public, yeah. One of our investigations involved allegations that a district government employee had improperly pressured or requested a subordinate to run personal errands. And some of the information related to that investigation is in the way of Uber records. And the type of information that is available that's stored by Uber, which would be very relevant to our investigation, such as trip logs and phone conversation recordings, GPS information that would show the routes that were taken, the times and dates, all of that stuff will not be turned over by Uber unless it is subject to a search warrant. And because we do not have the ability to do that, we are limited in our ability to gain that information. The only way that we will be able to gain that information with our current investigative limitations is with the consent of the Uber user, which we hope to secure through the employee's obligations to cooperate with our investigations. But if the employee does not consent, under our current limitations, we will not be able to obtain that information directly from Uber.
Understood. As you're looking into this, I'm sure I and the rest of the board would be interested in other ramifications. I can't imagine that they would ever make BEGA a law enforcement agency, but to the extent that we are seriously looking into it, I'd be interested in the other ramifications of such a request or a move.
Absolutely. We're looking at the variety of places in the district's code where a law enforcement agency is defined, and different definitions are provided in different contexts. So I'm hoping to identify a way that we might be able to be designated as a law enforcement agency with the authority to obtain those records in such a way that would be still within the council's comfort level. But I understand that it's a diplomatic issue, and we want to make sure that everyone is on the same page before we move forward and take any steps in that direction.
And in the short term, is it possible to partner with another agency? For example, the matter that you're referring to, which is at this point, I think, public, it came from a law enforcement agency. So they would have the authority, presumably, to get the information.
Possibly. And here's where it's, again, kind of diplomatic. Our first option is to secure the user's voluntary consent. And we hope that will come to pass. If not, the problem that comes up if we were to partner with the OIG, for instance, they've closed their investigation. So they might not be willing to exercise their rights or their powers to obtain that information if their criminal investigation has already been closed. So this may be an instance where we will need to work more closely with the OIG. So if we see any instances where we think that they may be on the verge of closing a matter because it interests the judicial economy or whatever, but we might need access to information that they could obtain to structure the closure of their investigation after they've assisted us in that manner. But I think it might be problematic in this instance because they've already closed the investigation. Let's see here. Rulemaking. We have reached out to the Mayor's Office of Talent and Appointments for their input on our proposal to adopt rules that require additional board and commission members to file public financial disclosure statements. I believe we're trying to schedule a meeting with them. Is that correct, Brian?
That's correct. Okay. Steve
Walker. Our budget review team meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, and we've continued to hold monthly budget meetings with A1 and his staff. Staffing. We still have two new administrative positions to fill. Interviews were conducted for the paralegal specialist position, and those applications are currently under review. However, I'm still evaluating our operations to determine if some other staffing pattern might be more advantageous or efficient than filling the two administrative positions previously identified. I'm not completely convinced that adding another administrative or two positions will really advance our mission as much as possibly adding another investigator or a data analyst. So far, I still need to be persuaded as to the need for additional administrative help when I see the bottleneck in our operations from a lack of investigators. So that would be my that's currently what I'm looking at.
Well, are you considering the paralegal support as administrative?
Yes. Yes. When I look at the job description and my conversations with folks around the office about the role that they envision that person playing, I'm not sure that it rises to the level of a full-time employee position need. So I want to make sure that before we move forward in filling any positions that we're making the most prudent, wise use of the public's money.
Makes sense. The one concern I have is going into budget season, not having filled those two positions, and the message that sends to Councilmember Allen and everyone else, the mayor, as to the need for those two positions.
Sure. I understand that we would definitely have to have a very tight messaging discipline, and also to act swiftly, that this shouldn't be a situation that we have to study for a couple months. You know, sometimes you have to make quick decisions, and it's my hope that I'd be able to come to the board with a recommendation by the time of its next meeting. Lobbyist financial disclosure matters. We're still working to get all non-compliant public financial disclosure statement filers to file their forms via our e-filing system. Since our last board meeting, we discovered that some non-filers are separated from the district. There are seven non-filers. We have submitted garnishment memos to OCFO in the fine amount of $300 for each non-filer, and our next step is to reach out to the non-filer supervisor or agency head. Confidential financial disclosure statements for calendar year 2017. We're currently reviewing CFDS reports and following up with ethics officers, and we will soon compile a list of CFDS non-filers and begin the enforcement process. Lobbyists. The 2018 lobbying season has started. Janet, do you want to provide an update on this? Or do you want me to do it? Okay. Okay. The activity reports reflecting lobbying activity during the last 6 months of 2017 are due next Wednesday, January 10th, and registrations are due by January 16th. We've responded to a number of legal questions and handled issues with the current e-filing system. The relevant filing statistics thus far are 57 registrations filed for 2018, 15 lobbying activity reports filed for the January 2018 reporting period, 37 termination reports have been filed, and in addition, OCTO is continuing to work on modifications to the new lobbying e-filing site. We are scheduled to preview the new site next Thursday, January 11th, and in light of the delays that have taken place to date in developing and implementing that system, I'm being closely involved in those discussions to make sure that nothing falls through the cracks. It's my goal to make sure that the system is up and running before the next financial disclosure filings in March, and that's going to require a lot of diligence from both Vega staff and OCTO. Non-confidential investigations our French. At the September meeting, you approved a notice of violation for Mr. French. Mr. French filed both his 2016 and 2017 confidential financial disclosure forms on November 6, 2017, which were 18 months and 6 months late, respectively. And after being served with a notice of violation, though Mr. French ultimately filed his forms, he filed them extremely late and has only been fined $300 thus far. On December 7th, 2017, we interviewed Mr. French, but have been unable to resolve this matter thus far. I believe we discussed this matter at our last meeting, and the initial thought was that perhaps we would proceed with a ministerial fine. Upon further reflection, I thought that this might be a good opportunity for us to take a little bit of a different direction. And I would be inclined to recommend that the board have a hearing on this, simply because I believe that it is part of my obligation as the director to pay particular attention to our staff development. And we have several very eager, talented, less experienced attorneys that haven't really had the opportunity to get a lot of quote-unquote trial work by presenting evidence and litigating cases. And I believe that the French matter would be a good opportunity for our staff to gain a little bit of that experience. So I will definitely defer to the board's wishes in this matter, but I think this would be a good staff development opportunity, and I would prefer to proceed in that route rather than a ministerial fine.
But before we get to that issue, I have questions about the calculation and the basis for the fine. So the 2016 report, I want to make sure we're talking about the right, that's what was due May of 2016?
Correct.
So he didn't file, we fined him $300 per our regulations that say $10 a day up to $300.
Which is, good morning, board member, sorry, which is a late fee,
which
I would classify as a late fee.
Correct.
Yeah.
So fast forward to 2017, he failed to file in May of 2017.
By May of 2017, he still had not filed his 2016 form or his 2017 form.
So the 2016 form has already, he's late. It's a year late at that point. May 2017 is when it's due. If I understand the regulation, it says $10 a day, excluding Saturdays and Sundays, up to $300. When we issued the notice of violation, what I'm confused about is he had not reached the 300 days when we filed the notice of violation, and perhaps this is his why he wants to present this to the board. At what point does it move from the regulation that authorizes a late fee of $10 a day, Monday through Friday, up to $300, to a ministerial fine? Because we had not exhausted the late fee time when we filed the notice of violation. I presume would kick it into...
I think we had exhausted it. So May 15, 2017, the 30 days would have been somewhere in June. He filed both of his forms this past November. So the notice of violation, I believe we did that in September, and I think we were well past his 30 days for 2017 at that point.
Okay.
And so I think where the ministerial fine came in is that he had kind of blown past being late, and we're kind of seeing a pattern of him, you know, willfully disregarding his filing requirements. He's done it twice in a row. And at the time of the notice of violation, we still had not received any filings from him. We had to continue to send him letters and emails, and I've talked to him on the phone in order to get him to file. So he filed, I want to say he filed November 9th, this past November 9th, and he was well past 30 days for both forms.
Okay. Okay, so the issue now is whether we move forward with the ministerial fine, which we already know he's going to appeal to the board, which resource-wise, I think that is the best decision, or whether we move forward with the notice of violation that we have already issued. Let me ask a policy question before we get to that issue. What is the benefit of filing the notice of violation instead of issuing the ministerial fine to begin with? What was the analysis done that made the board approve the notice of violation versus approving a ministerial fine, which actually doesn't require a board action?
Correct. My initial thought is that rather than doing the ministerial fine, which then would be appealed to the board, and I believe if it's consistent with most appellate practices, then the board would be capped at that as what would be the available remedy, because he would be appealing the fine, and if the board for whatever reason thought that the egregiousness of his conduct warranted a higher penalty, it would be capped by the ministerial fine. Whereas if we move forward with the notice of violation, I think the board has at its disposal all of the remedies, the monetary penalties available under the regulation.
Right. That makes sense, except in this case, I think the ministerial fine max is $5,000. Board's not going to – it's three? $2,000. Okay. Can't see us fining more than okay, so your recommendation is that we move forward with the notice of violation. Mr. Flowers.
I just want to address briefly your point earlier. At the time we filed the NOV, Mr. French had not filed his financial disclosure forms.
Right.
And so at that time, we were really trying to get him to file and to publicize this as an egregious instance of an employee not filing, and sort of to publicize and send a message.
It sends a message. And the ministerial fine is not necessarily public. You could submit a FOIA request for the information, I presume, but it's not something that is published in the D.C. Register or anything.
The NOV would have been published already.
The ministerial fine.
No, I understand. But didn't receive a lot of publicity. I don't know that we it served our purpose.
Okay. Do you all have any comments or thoughts on whether we proceed with the NOV, which would mean a full hearing on, I mean, there are no factual issues, really, but, or whether we move forward, and I understand the reasons why you want to, or whether we move forward with the ministerial fine, which will result in an appeal to us, but it's an appeal on the papers. That means Jack would be drafting some type of written response back.
Board members, I've spoken with Mr. French, and he expressed an interest in addressing the board. And I told him that he was welcome to attend our next meeting, but that first and foremost, he had to submit his appeal in writing to Mr. Grimaldi, but that he was welcome to attend the board meeting and possibly address the board in reference to his appeal. I'm not quite sure what he will say, but I did tell him that.
I am inclined to move forward with the ministerial fine only because I'm not sure that, given the fact of this case, that it would actually be of much educational value for the attorney. There's not going to be a whole lot of direct and cross-examinations. There's not going to be a whole lot of presentation of evidence. You can work on an opening and a closing, maybe. I don't feel that strongly about it. Do you all have any input?
It seems like the same, given the likely parameters of a hearing, that you would have the same opportunity to do a statement yourself from your office if Mr. French shows up and presents something.
Okay. I'm fine with issuing the ministerial fine. It would just, so if he does appeal it to the board, it'll just be a little bit of a different experience for Asia, and it'll be more like appellate practice as opposed to trial practice. So I'm fine with doing that.
But at one point, it is, I could see how it is a little confusing to the confidential and public filers, the fine process. I'm not sure that it's laid out anywhere. The form says up to $300 for late filing, and I think the form says $5,000 for incomplete filing. So I could see how it is a little confusing. No excuse. But we might want to make it very clear to people that we will fine you if you fail to file at all.
Sure. Makes sense.
Just make sure we're all on the same page here. Has he been fined ministerially yet? Okay, so that's step one.
He has for 2016.
Oh, correct.
First,
okay.
For the
first
one. Okay. He had a late fee.
Yes.
Okay. So he has not been ministerially fined for 2017.
No.
He
okay.
Advised.
No. Understood.
He will be. I don't know what. What constitutes the actual ministerial fine? Is it an order of some sort?
That would be my inclination. I don't know what has historically happened, but it would be my intention that any ministerial fine issued by me be reduced in writing with a recitation of the reasons why the fine was being put into place, so that we can kind of establish the purpose.
They've been imposed before, so whatever course
generally
he took before, I assume you would take again.
Generally, we submit a memo to OPRS requesting that they garnish the fine directly from their paycheck. And in the memo, it's usually two pages. We lay out like a short background and reasoning as to why we would like for them to begin the garnishment.
Okay.
And so it would just say, you know, the nature of whatever the violation was and, you know, whether or not they have been responsive and our authority to find the person. And that would be in a memo to OPRS.
How do they have the ability to appeal the fine if we automatically
We don't automatically garnish. In this instance, we've held off on the garnishment. And for another example, do you remember about 2 months ago, there was a woman who did a waiver request, and she had been fined $300 for her FDS, and we were basically, the fine was pending. The garnishment memo was pending while the board okay. decided whether or not we were going to take that course. So in a case like this where it's going to be appealed, we would hold off to see what the board would decide. But generally, when there is going to be a fine and there is an active current government employee, we do it by directly garnishing them. So the piece of paper that we have to point to say this is the basis for this fine is going to be the memo to OPRS.
And is the employee copied on that memo?
No. But for financial disclosure purposes, I'm in contact with non-filers, and I'm telling them this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to happen. And if they somehow say, I don't think that's fair or it's going to be appealed, they are aware of that process. And then, you know, when the appeals process turns out, you generally let them know what the board decided. And then at that point, I will let them know that I submitted the memo. And I usually do that by email. But no, they're not copied on that memo.
From a process standpoint.
Thank you.
I think it would be better to have an order of sorts from the director saying the ministerial fine is being imposed for these reasons, and advising the defendant of their right to appeal, sending the garnishment memo to
OPRS.
Sending the garnishment memo to OPRS with a notation to not take any action for 30 days or whatever the appeal period is, so that the garnishment memo is on hold. Basically, it's no action is being taken, or not actually forward the garnishment memo until the appeals period had expired.
That is the better option, yes.
That's generally what we do, that we just don't submit the memo until the whole matter has been resolved and we have a definitive answer as to whether they're definitely going to be fine. But for the late fees, we also do a memo, but generally that's automatic. But in this case, we had a person that was 2 years in a row, and we went through different phases. When we finally got him to come in, we talked to him, we interviewed him, we offered him a negotiated disposition. We gave him time to think about it. So there were different phases that we got to. He declined the negotiated disposition. So in my mind, the next step was to do the NOV and go to the hearing. And so, you know, we did that process. And so we've gone through different steps. But generally, if there's a case and there's an unresolved issue as to whether the person is going to be fine, I would not submit the memo until we had a final answer. If it's appealed, when the appeal turns out, then I would submit the memo to OPRS. So I think FDS, and this might be a unique situation because with our general cases, there's always going to be some sort of disposition. There's a negotiated disposition or is dismissed or we move forward with a hearing. So this was just we had to do a lot of discussion, I guess, to get where we are now. So we went through a lot of different phases, but the memo has not been submitted, of course, because we have no final resolution yet.
Okay. So I think would prefer to move forward with the ministerial fine versus a full hearing.
Will do. The other
non-confidential investigation I'd like to discuss is the Courtney Snowden investigation, which we briefly touched upon earlier in the board's meeting. The investigation was referred by the OIG involving the deputy mayor for greater economic opportunity. According to the OIG's report of investigation, on three occasions in late summer 2015, Ms. Snowden used government resources for other than official business and ordered, directed, or requested subordinate employees to perform personal services in violation of DPM sections 1807.1b and c. Janet has been in communication with Ms. Snowden's attorney. Ms. Snowden's attorney provided us some documentation that appears to be related to Ms. Snowden's Uber account, but does not necessarily appear to be as comprehensive as we would like or would ordinarily expect. So after discussions this morning and some additional research into our investigative limitations, we've decided we're going to prepare a voluntary consent asking Ms. Snowden to consent to our acquisition of this information directly from Uber. And if that does not work, then we will have to reevaluate our options. But that is our current plan, and hope to have that consent finished and delivered to Ms. Snowden's attorney by the middle of next week.
And does that conclude your report?
Yes.
All right, I'll now open it up to any public comments. We'll start with Mr. Sindrum. Good morning.
You sound well. And board members, all those with a sound my voice, Michael Sindrum, disabled veteran, served our country more than most. I want to follow up a comment made by Mr. Director, and that is this. You have all D.C. Government employees comply with the code of conduct. How is that possible when the D.C. government employees, the Public Service Commission, are exempted? And I'm thinking, following up on the French matter, Mr. French could waltz in your hearing or in a proceeding and say, hey, why have you exempted the Public Service Commission, D.C. public government employees, and not exempted me? And that would be a cogent argument. All to say that if you do it for one, you do it for all, or you do it for none. I've made mention of this before. Evidently, it's fallen on 10 ears, not good. But again, the Public Service Commission is rife with violations of the code of conduct, and they need to be reined in and brought under your watch. So I'm asking you, Madam Chair, board members, and Mr. Director, take this under close scrutiny and advisement and take action to have the Public Service Commission government, D.C. government employees brought under your watch. And I'd like to have some feedback from any of you all.
I don't have any feedback for you, Mr. Sindrum. Thank you for your comments. I recommend you take that to your council member for further discussion.
But there again, you can submit to the council, bringing to their attention there is exempted from BIGA, right, the Public Service Commission, D.C. government employees, and that ought not be. And for Councilman Allen and others to amend the law to include those folks. Because, again, Mr. French could make a very powerful argument saying you've exempted the Public Service Commission, D.C. employee government, so employees, and what about me? Which would rise to selective prosecution.
Thank you for your comments. Do we have any more public comments? Hearing none, I will now entertain a motion to move into executive session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-575B to deliberate on a decision in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-57B13 and personnel matters pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-57B10.
I move that we enter executive session.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. opposed. All right, the time is now 10:44. We've moved to executive session.
Thank you, Mrs. Simmons.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good-
All right, the time is now 11:04. We are moving back on the public record. We have nothing to report out. The next board meeting is February 1st at 10 a.m. Meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.